From North Carolina to Texas, Virginia to Iowa, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's party won a solid victory in this past week's parliamentary elections. Jim Phillips of the Heritage Foundation is here to explain what happened and examine the impact. Congressman Aaron Schock has resigned, triggering a special election in his Illinois district. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story behind the congressman's downfall. An employee at a Veterans Administration hospital in Louisiana blows the whistle on wrongdoing, and he ends up being the one who got punished. Tori Richards joins Eric Boehm for a Watchdog radio report. And the intolerance of the left is on full display as protests grow over a reality show featuring a traditional family. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Overcoming pre-election polls that predicted a tight race, the party of incumbent Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came out on top in last week's elections. Jim Phillips is a senior research fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation. He is here to discuss the ramifications of that election. Jim, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Jim, Israel held parliamentary elections this past week, a big victory for the incumbent Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his party. Could you give us an update on what occurred in that election?
Well, Prime Minister Netanyahu won a record fourth term as Israel's top leader by making a very strong surge at the end to win by coming from behind. He defeated the primary opposition party, which was a coalition between the Labor Party and a more centrist party. That coalition was called the Zionist Union, and it was predicted to win, to beat him by about four seats, but when the votes were tabulated, Netanyahu's Likud party, which is a conservative party, had won 30 seats to the Zionist Union's 24, and that was, in Israeli terms, is a very decisive victory. They were running for 120 seats in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, and because Prime Minister Netanyahu finished first, he will be given the first shot at trying to cobble together a coalition government with some of the other parties that were elected.
Of course, Americans are used to the fact that we vote directly for our president and one candidate or the other wins, and that's the head of government. As you've just described, this is a very different process, 120 seats in the Knesset and Benjamin Netanyahu's party winning only a fraction of those. So as he has an opportunity now, Jim, to form a government, tell us a little bit about that process, because it's something Americans just are not accustomed to.
Yeah, it's a lot more complicated than the American political system, where we have two major parties, and from time to time, you know, a third party pops up. But in Israel, 10 parties were elected to the Knesset, and it's a race to get to 61 seats to get the majority. That's the minimum needed to form a government. Likud now must reach out to other right-wing parties and religious parties and maybe even some centrist parties in order to get enough seats to put together a coalition government. And it's kind of like putting together a Rubik's Cube, because each one of these political parties has its own priorities and its own primary issues, and they're going to want to put their leaders in positions in certain ministries. So it's a very complex process to simultaneously negotiate with five or six other parties in which some of their demands may be conflicting.
As if that were not a complicated enough situation, as we look at the overall problems that are confronting this region of the world, Jim, what impact does the re-election of Prime Minister Netanyahu have on all the various conflicts that are going on in the Middle East?
Well, I think his re-election will keep Israel on a pretty much the same course it was on. So Israel will maintain a hardline stance against Islamist terrorism. Will be very cautious about negotiations with the Palestinians because the 1993 Oslo peace agreement really fell apart when the Palestinians did not hold to their promise of halting terrorism. And since then, Israel has withdrawn from Gaza back in 2005, only to see Hamas hijack Gaza, stage a coup, and turn it into a base for launching rockets against Israel. Because of that experience, Israel is going to be a lot more cautious about turning over land on the West Bank that could be used to threaten its heartland. So I think Prime Minister Netanyahu will continue his previous policies, maybe even more hardline on negotiations with the Palestinians. But the big source of friction with the U.S. besides that issue is going to be the Iran nuclear talks, where he has been a forceful critic of the Obama administration's negotiating strategy. And I think we're going to see that continue in the future.
In terms of Israel's relationship with the United States, Jim, historically, Israel has been one of our country's most solid allies. We've been one of their most solid allies. That relationship, of course, has been frayed, and the White House has been very tepid in its response to the Israeli election. Do you see any opportunity for President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu to come to any sort of common ground, or is it more likely that we're going to continue to see this relationship fray?
I think on some issues there's sufficient common ground so the two can cooperate very closely, especially when it comes to terrorism, perhaps containing the destabilizing spillover effects of the Syrian fighting. I think they're both on the same page pretty much there. But on other issues such as peace talks with the Palestinians, the settlements issue, and the Iran nuclear issue, I think they're going to continue to be at loggerheads. And there, the problem is not so much that they see different national interests, but they have entirely different worldviews, and those worldviews are very incompatible. Where I think President Obama famously likes to engage America's adversaries, but he's not all that warm and friendly to our allies, and that's not just Israel, but other allies also have complained. Saudi Arabia, for instance, is very alarmed by the Obama's negotiating strategy with Iran, as are other Arab countries. So it's not just Israel. So I think we're going to see continued tensions on the Iran issue.
Jim Phillips is the Senior Research Fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation. They, of course, based in Washington, D.C. Jim, tell us a little bit about the Heritage Foundation. What all do you do there?
We're a conservative research or think tank that is primarily aimed at informing and educating the U.S. Congress. We have a website at heritage.org.
Jim Phillips from the Heritage Foundation. Jim, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
At the offices of the Club for Growth, Andy Roth, of course, keeps an eye on everything happening in Congress and also key political races around the country. Andy, as always, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
We have a rare, somewhat rare, special election upcoming for a seat in Congress as a result of a resignation. A little bit unusual. Tell us a bit about it.
Yeah, I guess it started 45 days ago or thereabouts. Congressman Aaron Schock, a young man from Illinois in his third or fourth term, he abruptly resigned this last week. And it all started when a press report came out that he redecorated his house office to look like Downton Abbey. And if you look at the popular TV show from Great Britain, if anybody's not familiar with it, it's set in the early 1900s. So, and if you saw pictures of it, it's borderline gaudy, the the way that he redecorated his office. That started a kind of a snowball effect, because then they found out that the interior decorator that designed it did it for free, which is against the rules or against the law. Then they start finding out that he brought people on official trips and didn't account for it correctly. So all of this created a feeding frenzy by the media to investigate how Schock was spending his money. This culminated in what was going to be a news report about how he sought to get reimbursed for 171,000 miles on his car that he used for official business. He sought and received reimbursement for 171,000 miles. But he sold his car, and at the time, it only had 83,000 miles on it. So there was a discrepancy there. And when you get reimbursed for 50, 60 cents on the dollar, you're talking about some real money, like $100,000. And when it became known that that report was going to be released, I think Schock realized the gig was up, so he resigned. That has left this seat open. It's a very conservative district, despite being in Illinois, and there will be a special election, we suspect, in July. And a similar feeding frenzy is now occurring, where various people are jumping in and out of this race. But I suspect at the end of the day, a Republican will hold it.
So this is a dependably Republican seat. I would imagine then the issue will be, will we get a real conservative out of it, or will we get a rhino? Which way does this district tend to lean?
Aaron Schock was not very good on our issues, but he was a very capable politician. So I think that he was able to convince the voters that he was more reliably conservative than he really was. But I suspect that this district can elect a far more conservative candidate. What's interesting is that Ray LaHood, a former Republican and a very liberal Republican at that, who ended up being President Obama's transportation secretary, his son is thinking about getting into this race. Now, the immediate belief is that, well, like father, like son, the son will likely be just as squishy as the dad. There have been reports that that's not the case, and that the son could be to the right of the father, if not very much to the right. That remains to be seen. And there is a former lieutenant governor candidate named Jill Tracy who's thinking about running. She's in the pocket of the teachers union and is opposed to school choice. So right now, things don't look that great, but in my experience, it's way too early to be concerned. There's always opportunities for great candidates to step forward and file and run. We've got plenty of time.
We will continue to keep an eye on that race. Another area that we are continuing to monitor is the ongoing federal budget process. It's moving forward step by step. Where do we stand in that this week, Andy?
This is a big part of the year. You know, it's not just March Madness and opening day and the Masters. Politically, this is when a lot of the big things happen, namely the State of the Union, and then the president releases his budget, which immediately is dead in the water at Congress, regardless of the party. And then now is when Congress releases its budget, and that's what's happened. Since Republicans control both the House and the Senate, Republicans have released a House budget, and they've released a Senate budget. And it's going to get marked up in committee and then hopefully voted on in the floor in both chambers in the next few days. I can't go into great detail about the budget without spending 30 minutes explaining all the nooks and crannies, but I think the highlights include that there are instructions within the budget to repeal Obamacare. And I think fiscal conservatives are concerned that the instructions aren't tight enough and that it gives the Republicans a little wiggle room to renege on that. But with the court case coming up to get rid of the Obamacare subsidies that we've talked about in the past, if that comes up and goes our way, I think things make it easier for Republicans to repeal Obamacare or to really gut it, and this budget enables that. Conversely, this budget spends a little bit more or spends a lot more, depending on how you look at it, than we would rather prefer. So it's kind of like two sides of the same coin. There's some good things and some bad things, and at the end of the day, we just got to figure out if it's worth it. For me and the group I represent, it basically comes down to, can you trust leadership to execute what's in this budget? And I think a lot of people have a tough time answering that in the affirmative. So we'll see how it goes, and we'll move from there.
We have seen over and over again, Andy, where Republicans tend to get backed into a legislative corner by Democrats, even though now Republicans are numerically in the majority. Ultimately, does this budget still require the Senate to get over that 60-vote threshold?
No, and that's a good thing or a bad thing, depending on how you look at it. Senate rules recognize that the budget is the most important document of the year because it enables the Congress to appropriate our tax dollars and spend it on all the operations of the government. So it can't be held up by partisan infighting. So all it needs is a clear 51-vote majority in the Senate, and obviously the House it should pass easily, or it should pass if it's done on a party-line vote. The budget's not even signed by the president. It's not law. It's just a document that governs how Congress will spend money. So once it passes the House, passes the Senate, then they'll go to conference and reconcile their differences, which should be easy because it's within the same Republican Party. And then both chambers will vote on it again. And then they'll spend all summer figuring out how to abide by the budget and spend the money.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, tell us a little bit about the club.
Sure thing. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 100,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states of the Union, and we're united because we believe in economic liberty. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth from the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you very much. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Wrongdoing at a Veterans Administration hospital in Louisiana is exposed, and the whistleblower gets in trouble. Tori Richards joins Eric Boehm for this Watchdog Radio Report.
We've got a story today that will get your blood boiling if you're a veteran of this country or even if you're just a decent human being. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Watchdog Radio. Thanks for joining us here on American Radio Journal. My guest today is Tori Richards. She's an investigative reporter for Watchdog.org, and she's been spending the last several months digging into the VA, the Veterans Hospital, in Shreveport, Louisiana. Now, the VA scandal, of course, began in Phoenix more than a year ago, and it's really fun. Fallen off the front pages, even fallen off the back pages at this point. President Obama recently went out to visit the VA hospital in Phoenix and declared that all the problems there had been fixed. Well, maybe they'd been fixed in Phoenix, but in Shreveport, Tori has uncovered some really disturbing details. In fact, and like I said, if you're just a decent human being, this will get your blood boiling. Tori, I want to let you tell the story here, but let's just set up who the players are. First, you met with and talked with Shea Wilkes. He's a veteran himself, an employee of the VA in Shreveport, and he's a whistleblower by all intents and purposes. He came forward to say that a lot of what was going on at the Phoenix VA that became a national scandal, a lot of that was going on in Shreveport as well. But now he is actually under investigation by the government. Tell us a little bit about what happened with Shea Wilkes and what's going on at the Shreveport VA.
Yes, Mr. Wilkes is an Army veteran himself, and he just loves the military, and so he has a master's degree. He's been in Afghanistan, and he's a social worker at the Shreveport, Louisiana VA. And he just saw some wrongdoing, and if you recall, last year, everything blew up when a whistleblower from Phoenix VA reported that there were secret wait lists and people were dying waiting for appointments that had been going on for years. And coincidentally, or maybe not, the same thing was happening in Shreveport, Louisiana. And Mr. Wilkes had been trying to get this system fixed to no avail. he went to his bosses. He went to the VA Inspector General, which, by the way, they have posters all over various hospitals saying, you know, if you see wrongdoing, come to us. We'll help you, kind of an ombudsman program. So he had been trying to do this since 2013. And when all of this hit the news with Phoenix last year, he thought, hey, I'm going to do the same thing. Maybe it'll help. So he did. So he went to the media right afterwards, and he also went to a senator, a U.S. senator from Louisiana, and he told him the same story, saying, hey, you know, no one's doing anything. I've been on the inspector general for a year now. So the senator calls the inspector general and said, what are you guys doing? Well, the very next day, the IG comes out to visit Mr. Wilkes, and he thought, oh, hooray, they're going to help. But unbeknownst to him at the time, they were kind of angry. They wanted to investigate him as to why he had this list.
So he's got this document. He's got this list, evidence, essentially, that his superiors were creating these fake waiting lists and lying to veterans about how long they would have to wait to get care, which is just despicable. But he's got this list. And then in the eyes of the government, he is the one who's committed the crime here because he has the list? Is that, that's essentially what they're saying, that you've got a copy of the list, so you're in trouble for that. The guys who made the list, the guys who lied to the veterans of this country, well, we don't worry about that, but we worry about you because you've got a list? That just seems, that's crazy.
He was trying to get the IG to wake up and do something, so they came and demanded any copies that he may have had, and he had one squirreled away in a ceiling tile and locked in his desk, and he downloaded his computer. So he made all these copies in case one of them would disappear. And so they took his hard drive, and they took all these lists, and then he finds out from them that he is under criminal investigation for having.
And then just to make the whole situation even worse, let's shift gears and talk about Patrick Magali, because in your story, a story that folks can read at watchdog.org, Patrick Magali is the guy who should be in trouble here, not Shea Wilkes. Magali was his superior, and the guy, like I said, who should be in trouble, should be under investigation. What is going on with him?
Oh, ironically, Mr. Magali was the one that Shea Wilkes went to and said, hey, I don't know if you know, but we have this list. Like, this isn't right. And he was just busy shuffling papers in his office and didn't want to listen or hear and said, okay, fine, thanks, bye. And then he did nothing, and so Shea went to the IG, and so it was him. So, yes, while this has been going on and blowing up, and according to Mr. Wilkes' attorney, the special counsel has governmental deadlines to meet with their investigation, so they think something is going to come down soon on this. And so coincidentally, or maybe not, the chief of staff, by the way, I'm going to sit down. I think I'll go back to the emergency room and be a doctor there. Oh, that's what I'll do. So he is a doctor. He's going to go back there and do whatever he's going to do and return to his roots of teaching at a local university there. Before he leaves, by the way, it's like he gave I think a 2 weeks notice or something like that. The director of the entire hospital went on leave, and so he's filling in for him.
This is the type of thing that only can happen in government. It seems like that you have a guy who is trying to do the right thing, trying to tell, first trying to tell his supervisors, but then when they wouldn't listen, trying to tell the public that, look, this is a serious problem. We've got people who are lying to the veterans of this country, the people who deserve care more than anybody else, that the government is charged with taking care of. And not only does, you know, do his supervisors not listen, but then he actually gets in trouble for trying to do the right thing while his supervisor ends up, you know, I don't want to say promoted necessarily, but certainly not reprimanded, certainly not fired. And so a really great story, and we appreciate you bringing it to us, and we wish all the best for Shea Wilkes, and hopefully all of this works out since he's made the decision to go public. As I said, unfortunately, we are out of time. You can check out the full story at watchdog.org. You can check out all of our other Watchdog reporters' work up there as well. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at WatchdogORG, and check out our new Watchdog podcasts. They're on iTunes and Stitcher. For Watchdog Radio, I'm Eric Boehm. You can catch us, as always, right back here again next week on American Radio Journal.
You wouldn't think a reality show featuring a large traditional family would trigger much opposition, but the intolerant left is creating an uproar. Dr. Paul Kingor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Liberals claim they're all about tolerance, but of course they only tolerate people and ideas they agree with. We've all seen countless such examples, and I'd here like to share a new one. It concerns the Duggar family. If you're not familiar with the Duggars, there are, well, 19 of them. They're devout evangelicals following what they believe is God's plan for their family and fertility. That mere reproductive fact infuriates a large number of people on the left. But to make liberals' nightmares worse, the Duggars display their lifestyle in a popular reality TV show broadcast by the Learning Channel. That the Duggars have a platform is driving many leftists into fits of rage. Once again, jettisoning their sacred cows, tolerance, diversity, and let's add freedom of expression in opposition to censorship, liberals are insisting that the Duggars show be canceled. While 19 Duggars is a lot, they pale compared to the 190,000 signers of the petition to remove them. The petition is spearheaded by a gay rights group called Change.org, which, of course, only supports change that it believes in. The original purpose of the petition was to protest a certain local transgender issue involving something that Mrs. Duggar did off the air in her private life. The show never deals with gay issues. Regardless, the petition has served as a rallying point for every gripe against the Duggars' lifestyle. Just listen to some of the statements by the petition signers. Quote, "Because 19 kids is irresponsible," declares one signer of the petition. "They're having way too many. There are other valued things a young woman can do besides get married and be pregnant a month later. I personally think the Duggars are sending a terrible message. There's more to life than being a human baby machine." Unquote. Never mind that this is Mrs. Duggar's reproductive choice, something that liberals have always claimed to champion. Here are more examples from the petition website. From Emily, "These people have no respect for women. If you want to talk about a lifestyle that's disgusting and dangerous, I'd say the Duggars take the cake." From Annie, "They disgust me. Their religious beliefs and overpopulation are inexcusable." From Laura, "It's a vagina, not a clown car." From Lauren, "As a female, I'm personally offended at how backwards and retrogressive the Duggars are. Notice how the females are only taught to aspire to marriage and nothing more. They are then taught to lay on the backs for the rest of their lives with their legs spread to constantly reproduce. Oh, and they cook, too." From Nicholas, "The Duggars are child abusers who desire to spread their cult. Why celebrate anyone's ability to hyper-procreate and indoctrinate?" From Samuel, "Please spay and neuter your Duggars." And finally from Jennifer, "They should be tarred and feathered and run out of town on a rail." These are just some of the thousands of statements against the Duggars at the petition website. And all of this is so sad, especially given that the Duggars are obviously happy. They're among the most contented people you'll find amid the wretched squalor, rancid sorrow, moral obtuseness, and parade of depressing misery that pollutes and pervades TV's litany of awful offerings. Liberals are doing to the Duggars what they always accuse their opponents of doing, hating. If you're against paying for other people's contraception and abortion, then you hate women. If you're against redefining marriage, regardless of your religious beliefs, well, then you hate gay people. On and on it goes. But if you want to see hate, look at the hate channeled at the Duggars. Liberals don't like the Duggars, and thus they don't want you to be able to watch them. And that's not tolerance. For American Radio Journal, this is Paul Kengor. Check out my writings at faithandfreedom.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on over 200 public affairs-minded radio stations in 45 states across the country. They include our newest affiliate, WTIMAM, in Somerville, Massachusetts. Welcome to our new listeners in the Bay State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.